And I'm going to start today with a story. And I hesitate to share the story. I didn't really want to share the story. I've never told anyone this story. But it fits where I'm going. It has to do a little bit with karma. And I couldn't think of a better story to segue into this notion of karma. And, I mean, everybody knows what karma is. You know, it's an old concept that, you know, it kind of originated with some Indian religions. And honestly, it just makes a lot of sense. Like, even though it is like kind of an Indian religion kind of thing, if we could take it and insert it into Christianity, I think a lot of us would like that. I think the idea of karma makes a lot of sense to us. Good people get good things, bad people get bad things. I think we like that idea. And so I was trying to think of a story that could kind of capture that idea, and I realized that about a month ago, something happened to me that actually disproves karma. And I know that it's thousands of years old and billions of people believe in it, but it was actually me that disproved it. So karma doesn't exist, and it was me that did that. Gosh, I hesitate to share this story. It was about a month ago, and Kristen and I were having dinner with the Rainers, Mark and Aaron, and they're not here today, so I would kind of appreciate you guys keeping this, you know, between us as like just a family, because they don't know about this, and it has to do with them, and Aaron is like the sweetest person in the world. She definitely does not deserve bad things to happen to her, but something bad did happen to her, and she still doesn't know about it, and it was my fault. And so, you know, we go out to eat. We went to Elizabeth's Pizza. I had a salad. It was delicious. Has nothing to do with the story. And then we go back to their apartment. They want to show us their apartment. So we go in, and we're sitting there, and we're talking. We're laughing, having a good time. And I go to the restroom. And so I'm in there, and I'm washing my hands, and, you know, just washing my hands, getting ready to dry them. And I'm still looking in the mirror, and I reach back for the towel because, you know, got to keep looking in the mirror because this doesn't happen by accident. And so I reach back and I start drying my hands, and immediately I think to myself, that is the softest towel I have ever used. And I turn around and she had a dress hanging in the bathroom, and I was just rubbing my sopping wet hands all over it. And went back outside. I was like, Kristen, we gotta go. And I mean, it looked like she was going somewhere nice. I don't know if she was. But it's been a month now and nothing bad has happened to me. And so I don't know if that necessarily disproves karma, but it will prove whether or not Mark and Aaron listen to the podcast on weeks that they're not here. So don't say anything about that. You know, the idea of karma, it does make a lot of sense to us. The idea that good people get good things, and bad people, when they do something bad happens to them. This appeals to us. This satisfies something inside of us that just feels right, because something in the human heart hates evil. We just hate bad things. You know, we see it really easily in other people. Sometimes it's hard to see it in ourselves, but man, we can spot it in somebody else pretty quickly. And there is something inside of us that responds instantly to something bad going on. When someone's being taken advantage of, when someone's being oppressed or hurt, or just annoyed by someone else, we can feel it. It bothers us. It sits on us. And we really, really hate that, but we love that Jesus seems to hate these things too. The idea that Jesus would hate the same thing that we hate, badness, that appeals to us. And so when we come across passages in Scripture that affirm this idea, that God is against bad, that Jesus is against bad, this is a good thing for us. We grab those verses and we hold on to them, and they tend to stick in our memory pretty well. There is one such verse in the Old Testament. It's Exodus 21:24, and we don't need the whole verse up there. I really kind of just cut out about half of it when we have it up here. And it is an extremely famous verse. This is one of those celebrity verses that kind of exist without context. People know it without context. And the verse is eye for eye, tooth for tooth. That's essentially it. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. And this idea, this concept in the Old Testament, this Old Testament law that exists in Exodus 21:24, is known as the lex talionis. It is the law of retaliation. And this law is oftentimes used to summarize, to capture something about the Old Testament, a harshness, a vengefulness, a more barbaric time than what we have pictured in the New Testament. We have an Old Testament harsh law versus a New Testament grace. We have a God who is almost a little bit vengeful versus the Jesus who is a little bit more about love. There is a dichotomy there, and we see it really summarized in this verse, maybe more than any other in the Old Testament. And this is a terrible, terrible misunderstanding. You see, back in the time frame where this law was given, there were all sorts of other nations. that the Hebrews were wandering around throughout the soon-to-be, well, where they were in the wilderness and soon-to-be promised land. They were surrounded by other nations. And these other nations had laws governing them as well. And in the case of personal injury, which is what this verse is about, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, in the case of personal injury, these other nations had laws governing how that was supposed to work. And almost unanimously, actually, it wasn't known of another nation that had a law like the Hebrews. In all other known nations, the response was, if I injure you, I compensate you financially. That was the way it was handled. I harm you, I pay you. That was the way they handled personal injury. And then God's law comes down the pipe, and instead of financial compensation, it is, I harm you, you harm me back. And at first glance, this seems a step in the wrong direction, right? Like, it seems like progress would be going the other way. This seems more barbaric, more violent. And so this seems a little bit backwards. But there is beauty in this law. There is something very beautiful underneath this law. God is doing what he's always doing. He is protecting people. See, in the other way, where financial compensation would solve the problem, there was a huge problem with this. Rich people didn't care about losing a little bit of money. If they wanted to harm someone, all they knew is, I pay them off and that's it. I still get to harm someone when I want to. And so the poor people would be oppressed under this idea. Furthermore, the oppressors, because they were taking advantage of this law, they were creating a system where the poor were getting increasingly frustrated with the situation. And so they would respond, forget about the money. They would simply respond, violence for violence, tit for tat. And they kind of had the same idea as violence has always worked throughout Scripture, which is it increases, it escalates. This is the way violence works. You put one of mine in the hospital, I'll put one of yours in the morgue. This is the way that things were working back then. There was an increasing tension and frustration, and it was getting worse and worse and worse, and God saw this and created a law, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. And this actually solved the problem. Because although the poor under the other way were being oppressed, in this new way, this new law, it actually created a type of arms race where the poor, when they were harmed, had every right to harm the rich back physically. And so the rich there was a deterrent in place for them. And the response also limited that. The response was limited by the law as well. This law that God gave, the Lex Talionis, was designed to deter and to limit violence. It was designed for shalom. The shalom of God, the peace of God, to reign in the people. And the point was never to punish the bad with eye for eye. The point of this law was always to cure bad. That was the difference. But that design, however, got lost throughout time, as it oftentimes does. And as we've been going through the Sermon on the Mount, this is kind of what Jesus has been doing. He's looking at old laws, seeing where they are broken, and he is trying to either repair them or restore them. Well, this one wasn't necessarily broken. It was simply ignored. As time had passed, there was an increasing class separation. The rich were more rich and more elite, and the poor were more poor and more oppressed. And so the poor were basically in a situation where, although this law was in place eye for eye, nobody was following it. The rich would oppress them, and if someone tried to respond back, they would get thrown in jail. This was creating a terrible, terrible situation. The reality of the situation when Jesus walked the earth is the bad guys were winning. The bad guys were doing whatever they wanted, and there was nothing stopping them. And so the people, they come to Jesus, and they see this man who they believe is their Messiah, and they say, we are being oppressed, we are being harmed, we are being shut down. What do we do? How do we come out from under this regime surrounding us? And Jesus looks at them in their suffering, and he says to them, let them. Now, this is really hard, but if you turn in Matthew 5, we see what Jesus says. Matthew 5, starting in verse 38, he says, you've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I tell you, do not resist an evil person. Whoever slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone wants to sue you and take away your tunic, let him have your cloak also. And whoever compels you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 as well. People are being beaten. People are being robbed. People are being forced to go where they didn't want to go, and Jesus responds to this, let them do it. Let them walk all over you. That can't be right. That just can't be right, because Jesus is against abuse. We know this. He hates abuse like we hate abuse. He hates oppression like we hate oppression. This cannot be right. And that's true. But the reality was is that these things were already happening. The reality of the situation was oppression was happening, abuse was happening, and Jesus saw the way that the story was going to end. Now, it might be because my boys are 6 and 4, but I've been thinking a lot about superpowers recently. And, it's just because everything in my house has to do with superheroes. I mean, if you ask my boys on any given day, they are Batman and Robin, and you try to call them anything else, and they're going to start crying. And so superheroes and superpowers are very much on my mind, and I'm actually kind of convinced I might have some. I might have superpowers. Like, for one, I believe I can make people feel certain types of emotion. I know for sure that I can make Kristen angry without doing anything. And so I get permission for those kind of jokes, by the way. That's not new to her. And also, as far as I know, I'm immortal. Now, time will tell on that one, but so far as I know, I'm immortal. But there is a superpower that I think we all have, well, at least married couples. I think when you get married, this is a superpower bestowed upon you. You may not have it when you're just a mild-mannered single person. But the minute you get married, I think this superpower is bestowed upon you, and it is the ability to see the future. Now, not in all things, but only regarding fights. Because fights don't come out of nowhere, right? Any married person in this room will attest. You see a fight coming. Like, it's not something where you walk in a room and boom, you're fighting. That's never how it works. You're laying in bed and you see, you're like 20 minutes from now, things are gonna get bad. You just know, you can feel the tension. You can feel the frustration. You know we are not connecting in a good way right now. And unless one of us backs down, there's gonna be a fight 20 minutes from now. That's seeing the future. That's knowing where things are going. And in this situation, Jesus sees the future. Jesus is walking around Jerusalem, seeing the oppression, seeing the frustration in response to the oppression, and he sees where this is going. He sees that violence is on the horizon here unless someone backs down. The culture was tense with oppression and abuse and frustration and revolts, and Jesus feels this tension, and he proposes a new way. And this is where I need a volunteer. And I asked for one. I don't know where he is, though. Where is he? Lewis, come up here. You are my volunteer of choice today. Jesus proposes a new way. Now, Lewis is going to be playing the part. Scoot over. There you go, right there. Lewis is going to be playing the part of the oppressed person for today's message. And I am the oppressor. You are just a lowly Hebrew servant. It doesn't matter who you are. And so in this passage in Matthew 5:38, Jesus paints a new picture, a new way. And in the first scene, he articulates something really neat. He articulates a response to physical abuse. Now it says, if someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. Now what Jesus is talking about right here is physical abuse. Now me being of a more lofty place than Lewis, I would never strike Lewis like this. Cultures have certain patterns, and in Hebrew culture, much like a culture today might say, you don't eat with your left hand. This dominates certain cultures in our world, even today. In Hebrew culture, I would never strike Lewis with my left hand. It would only be my right hand. I would never fight anyone with my left hand. I don't know why it was that way, but it was that way. And so to strike Lewis, someone who is beneath me, if I were to only use my right hand, it would be a backhanded slap. This puts him in his place. This tells him not only I want to beat you, which it does communicate that pretty well, but it also tells him you are beneath me. I keep touching your beard. It feels nice.
I condition.
Yeah. Now say I slap you, Lewis. Turn a little bit right there. I'm angry at Lewis. I'm above him, and I slap him, and he immediately goes down because I just hit hard like that. And the response of Jesus is not, the response of Jesus in this case is not, Lewis, man, you're stealing my thunder, dude. Just is not to just grin and bear it. It's not take it. It's not lay down and let yourself get walked all over. The response of Jesus is to what? Turn the other cheek. Rise back up and turn the other cheek to me. Now, this is an intentional, exactly, just, that is exactly, that is, I mean, you look goofy doing it, but that's exactly what Jesus is doing. Because when you do this, it creates a problem for me. Suddenly, I cannot conveniently smack him with the back of my hand. This is, all of a sudden, just, it doesn't, keep your head turned. I can't get to where I want to hit him. And it forces me to make a decision. It forces me to make a decision. Will I either strike Lewis with the open palm of my right hand, thus putting him in a position of being equal to me, or will I stop hitting him? Either one of these is a win for Lewis. He probably wants me to stop hitting him. But even if I do hit him, I'm hitting him, but I'm saying you're my equal while I'm doing it. This is responding to violence without resorting to violence. And it's really beautiful. And then Jesus moves on to a second scene. And in the second scene, he says, if someone takes you to court and takes your shirt, give him your tunic also. It was extremely common in that day for someone who is indebted to someone else to just be robbed blind, for mercy to not be shown to them. I would take your land. I would take your resources. I would take anything that you had. And then if you ran out of stuff and you still owed me money, I would take you to court and sue you for the very shirt off your back. Now, after that, Jesus says they want to take you that far. They want to display that so much lack of mercy for your situation. Just keep giving to a person like that. Give him your tunic as well. You don't need to act this out, by the way. And so give him your tunic as well, thus leaving in a culture of only two garments, Lewis buck naked, standing in front of me. Knew I should have gotten a different volunteer. Now, if you were here a few months ago, you remember we talked about nakedness a lot. If you weren't here, you're like, why on earth? Now, if you were here, you remember we talked about nakedness. Now, in our day, if Lewis is naked, who feels shame? In our day. Well, maybe a little bit. Maybe Caleb. But and so anyway, if Lewis is naked, Lewis feels shame. In our day, he would be ashamed. He'd be standing in front of people. He would be the one embarrassed. But in the day, in the culture of first century Judaism, if Lewis is naked, who feels the shame? The people, specifically the one who made him that way. Specifically the one who forced him to be naked. Essentially, Lewis stands there naked, and everyone looks at me and says, you should be ashamed of yourself. And shame is a powerful motivator. Suddenly, in this context, the person who is the taker becomes the giver. Not wanting to feel shame, I'm giving Lewis back his stuff, the stuff that I wanted to take from him in the first place. It turns me from a taker to a giver. It changes the dynamic. It's another beautiful scene pictured up by Jesus. And then Jesus moves into the last one, and this one's got to be my favorite. This is the one where it says, go the extra mile. We know we've heard this before. Now, in this culture, there are Roman centurions walking all over the area. And these Roman centurions had every right under Roman law to take their heavy, weighed down, bulky gear and find some guy off the street, really anybody off the street, and give it to them to carry for them for up to 1 mile. Doesn't matter what Lewis is doing. Doesn't matter who he's doing it with. He could be hanging out, just enjoying his day. I can grab him and force him to walk with me 1 mile. So here's my stuff, and you keep walking. Now, the same, very good. Now, the same Roman law that allows me to force him to go 1 mile with me is the same Roman law that prohibits me from letting him take a single step beyond a mile. I could be punished. I could be beaten if I continue to abuse Lewis under this way. And so if he keeps walking, if he insists upon going a second mile, suddenly you have turned the dynamic. You could stop so I have room. Suddenly the dynamic has turned and me, the Roman soldier, is standing in front of just a peasant boy begging for my stuff back so that I don't get beaten, just begging him so that I don't get punished for what he's doing. You can go ahead and sit down. It completely turns. Good job, Lewis. Everybody give him a hand. It turns the entire dynamic on its head in that last one, where, and it's almost comical that a huge Roman soldier would be begging a little boy to give him his stuff back. This entire picture is really, really beautiful. Jesus was essentially ending, in that last one, forced labor. Imagine if everybody went an extra mile every time a Roman soldier dumped his gear on somebody else, and that person insisted on going 2 miles, resulting in punishment for the Roman centurions. Eventually, they would stop asking. Jesus actually painted a picture that ended forced labor. It was amazing. It was comical. It was brilliant. People see this teaching, and they're responding to it because it makes a lot of sense. It's neither submission nor is it assault. It's neither fight nor is it flight. This is amazing, and we can embrace it because it meets all of our criteria. Jesus is still who he is, grace and love. But the bad guys still get what's coming to them. And we like that. That's the way this new way works. It forces them to act a certain way. It shames them into giving back to us. And it punishes them if they abuse us. It answers the question, how do we stop ourselves from being abused? And that's kind of the problem, because that was never the question. In all of this beautiful teaching that Jesus throws out there, we completely missed the point again, because the question never was, how do we stop ourselves from being taken advantage of? Matthew 5, 43 through 48, Jesus continues in this passage. And he says, you've heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy. But I say to you, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, do good to those who hate you, and pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you, that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. For he makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good. He sends rain on the just and the unjust. For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet your brethren only, what do you do more than others? Do not even the tax collectors do so? Therefore, you shall be perfect just as your heavenly Father is perfect. Jesus is not ending abuse for the sake of the innocent. It's not about us. It's not about that. He is ending it for the sake of the oppressor. Once again, God is looking out for the oppressor as much as he is looking out for the oppressed. This is the exact same pattern we see in the Old Testament under the eye for the eye picture. God's defense of the wrongdoer. Jesus wasn't attempting to free people from oppression. He was freeing oppressors from their sin. He was saying to them, if they could only see their brokenness, they wouldn't be the way they are. And it's up to us to move them from where they are to where they could be. He's saying, do whatever you can to help make them see. You know, I've talked about blind spots before. I think we did a series here called the Johari Window, where we talked about this idea. And the idea of a blind spot in that series, and really down through even to today, is that we are a bunch of annoying people. Like all of us in this room, we all annoy people, every one of us. Now, I know I have things. I don't know exactly what they are, but there are those of you out there who are annoyed by me, my very presence. I walk into a room, and you are annoyed. And that's just the way it is. Now, if I knew what it was that I did that annoyed you, I would certainly stop. I promise you I'm not doing it on purpose. But it's there, and the truth is I just don't know about it. And the good thing, the reason I can sleep at night knowing that I am annoying, is that you're annoying too. Some of you are close talkers. Some of you are loud talkers. Some of you probably have bad breath. Some of you just talk about yourselves too much. Some of you, I mean, everybody in this room has something that annoys someone else. If you're ready to be insecure, that's just the way it is. And people know it. Everybody knows it. We're just not telling you. And so you're going through life annoying people, and nobody is telling you. This is the way life works. We have these blind spots that are just a part of the social structure of life. And we don't know because no one will tell us, and we don't know because we really don't want to see them. What Jesus is saying through this entire picture is we have got to show people these blind spots, or they're never going to grow. They're never going to get better. They're never going to move from where they are to where they could be. In Matthew 5, 44 through 45, he talks about loving the enemies and praying for his enemies so that you may be sons of your Father in heaven. You love them. You give up your rights, your privileges, your lives so that they may know God. You pray for them, for the people who abuse you, who swindle you, who harm you. These are the people who we pour out our prayers for, so that we may be sons of our Father, like Jesus is son of the Father. I remember growing up, my grandmother had a cross that she would hold every time the lottery came around. Like, she would be watching the lottery, clutching a cross, just praying that God would pour out financial victory for her. And that's what's happened. The cross throughout time has become a symbol of personal victory. We see baseball players make the sign of the cross when they hit a home run. We see people turn to the cross as some sort of symbol of victory in their personal lives, and I'm not sure this was the way it was supposed to be seen. The cross was the moment that Jesus lost the most. The cross was the moment that Jesus was the most taken advantage of. And he says, take up your cross and follow me. It was an invitation to suffer and to lose. The cross was a symbol of losing, not victory. Take up your cross and follow me if you want to be my disciple. If you want to be a Christian, this is the invitation for you. It is to take up the picture, the symbol of losing, and follow Jesus. This is what Jesus did in Matthew 4 when he was hungry. The tempter came to him and said, you are the one who you say you are. You could turn these bread, this bread, or this stone, these stones into bread. And Jesus says, man does not live on bread alone, but every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. He does not deny the claim that he could turn stones into bread. He simply doesn't do it. And in Matthew 26, 53, when he is attacked and he is put on the cross, it is turned to him and it is said, if you're the Son of God, you can just get down from here. And he said, my Father could send legions of angels if I so called on him to do so. Jesus was oppressed and he was in painful, harmed situations, and he chose not to alleviate his suffering. Jesus is teaching throughout the Sermon on the Mount to be like him. Suffer even if you shouldn't have to. When we look through the history of the Bible, we see a long history of suffering. Job suffered for faithfulness. The Hebrews suffered for discipline. James taught suffering that it produced some sort of perseverance in us for the betterment of ourselves. Throughout the history of Scripture, we see a personal betterment through our suffering, but this is not the suffering that Jesus is talking about on the Sermon on the Mount. This is different. This suffering has nothing to do with what the sufferer gets out of it. This suffering isn't something God subjects us to for our good. It's something we subject ourselves to for the good of someone else. The cross that we carry is a symbol of victory, but it's just not ours. We do carry a cross, and it is someone's victory, but it's not for us. We lose so that other people can win. You may ask, why does God emphasize victory for the oppressor, the guilty? Why are provisions made for the worst of the worst from Exodus through the time of Jesus? And it's because God is the anti-karma. Where karma says the good people get good things and the bad people get bad things, God responds with goodness available to everyone. He says, I make rain fall on the just and the unjust alike. And he says, I send my love for the best and the worst of you all. This is the love and sacrifice and laying down of our lives that we're called to ourselves. It was Mother Teresa who said, unless a life is lived for others, it's not worthwhile. And George Guynemar said, if one has not given everything, one has given nothing. If you would please bow your heads and pray with me.